One day, someone asked me a question. Why is there so much singing in church? I can like the readings, I can survive the sermon, but really, why on earth do we spend half our time singing? Most of the people in the room are not that great of singers. Very few people are. There's a lot of things we could do. Why sing? The answer begins to unfold in the book of Genesis when God makes a prophecy to Abram. He says, "Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be slaves there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out." And you remember how this prophecy comes to pass? After the God predicted 400 years that the Israelites were slaves to Egypt, Pharaoh declares war on the God of Israel when he says, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile. Each and every pregnant Israelite woman prays all day and all night that she have a little girl so that her baby's not aborted when he's born." And the preacher's wife gives birth to a boy. And when she does, she must have thought God did not listen to her prayers, that God had no use for her child. And in accordance to the command, baby Moses is set in the river. But then you remember he's discovered, brought into the palace. Instead of being raised by the preacher, he's raised by the princess. Instead of being raised in the parsonage, raised in the palace. Until he kills an Egyptian and goes out in hiding. But even there, God speaks to him, beckoning him from a burning bush and calling him to come back to Pharaoh to announce the plagues culminating in the 10th. Every firstborn of the land of Egypt shall die. Pharaoh, in grief and disbelief, faces the penalty for his murder of the Israelite baby boys. But then he quickly second guesses his decision to let them go. Did he think God was out of ammo? Did he think nothing worse could ever happen? Did he not care, but just wanted to see God suffer too? So Pharaoh summons up the best military technology of the day, chariots. He gets his 600 chariots and every other chariot they can find and commands his whole army to go out with them, even leaving his home unprotected. He aims every bow, every spear, every blade in Egypt is sent out against the unarmed men, women, and children on foot. He was not going out to recollect dismissed slaves. He was going out for a massacre. Meanwhile, the Israelites feel in their guts the ground shaking as the army comes at them. But they feel at their back the sea breeze trapping them. And when they have no hope on earth, they turn their eyes to heaven and cry out to the Lord. And God commands them at first to stand firm. Fear would tempt them to run. Impatience would tempt them to fight. Presumption would tempt them to go around and say their goodbyes to loved ones. But the Lord commands them to stand firm until the moment comes when all the prayers have been said and no hope is available, and then at the perfect time, God acts. A strong east wind cuts through and parts the sea in half, like an usher opening a door for you. Was it the breath of God blowing on the waters like you or I cooling a cup of coffee? Or was it 100 million invisible angels standing shoulder to shoulder, blowing with all their might? Or was each drop of water just doing what we have so much trouble doing, pausing in obedience to God? In Psalm 77, Asaph sings about it this way. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, yet your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. The Egyptian army then sees their prey running away to safety, and they are left with a decision to make themselves. In bloodlust, do they go pursue their prey? Or do they turn around the chariots and head home? And they go in for the kill, but their polished wheels are swallowed in mud. Their flashing chariots become immobile anchors. And in one moment, there's a thunderous crash of water, and all is silent. As you continue to read through your Bible, Israel has a long way ahead of them, and they'll have plenty more obstacles to overcome. But as you go through thousands of pages and thousands of years, the Egyptian army never bothers them again. And how do the Israelites respond? Did they go spit on the bloating corpses floated in the water? Did they grab a pitcher of Gatorade and dump it over Moses' head? Tap a keg, pat themselves on the back for a job well done? No. They sing. It gets to be a little bit like a musical. Right after this big moment, what do? Moses sings. I get a little impatient with songs sometimes if they're more than like three verses. Moses goes on for 19 verses spontaneously. And when he runs out of breath, his big sister Miriam takes over. She picks up a tambourine that had 400 years of dust on it. She pulls out some dancing shoes that she put away the day Moses was born. And she grabs every woman in Israel, and together they sing a refrain. It probably wasn't pretty. It probably wasn't quiet. It probably wasn't sweet. These were women who were forced by Pharaoh to drown their newborn babies. When they finally pass over into freedom, and they know it's the Lord who did it, and they get to sing to him, it doesn't sound like a sweet little church choir. It doesn't sound like a mother's lullaby. It sounds like 100,000 lions roaring. Now, the passing through the sea is a historical event, but it also prefigures God's work in Jesus. Like God frees the Israelites from physical slavery to Egypt, in Jesus, God frees us from spiritual slavery to sin. Like Pharaoh pursues Israel, seeking the destruction of their lives, Satan pursues us, seeking the destruction of our faith. Like Israel must obediently pass through the waters to freedom, Christians must obediently pass through the waters of baptism. Like the Egyptian's death gives Israel freedom, Jesus' death gives Christians freedom. Jesus says, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. But if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." It's not easy to remain a Christian in the world today. Politicians may sneer at you. Reporters may knock at you. Family and friends may roll their eyes at you. But you used to be a slave to your sin and now know the freedom of forgiveness. You used to be trapped in certain death, but now have the hope of a new life. You used to see death as the unavoidable, bleak, meaningless end, but now know it is the gateway to joy. So as Brian and Lori come up, please rise and join Moses, who started singing at the side of the sea and kept singing even with his last breath. Join Miriam and all those grateful, relieved mothers. Join the saints before us and the angels all around us as together with them we sing.